old and dear friends and friends of recent day as well as the past. Let me first of all congratulate you, President Meany, on your re-election. I would have been satisfied with just one election. Let me also, as a friend and a brother, express my good wishes and my congratulations to your executive council, to the membership assembled here in your 10th Constitutional Convention. You may recall that I was with you on your first AFL-CIO Constitutional Convention. But one thing I'll bet you don't recall, we made history that day. I was introduced, and I was told you can have 2 minutes. I took one. Never again will that ever happen. Never. And I've been using some Nixon economics, and I found out that if you saved that 1 minute that I had left over and permitted it to accumulate compound interest under the present high interest rate schedule, you're due to be here until Wednesday. But I'll try to be more generous and more considerate. You know, the story of my life has been bad timing. Bad timing. I thought I might come down here when I could really give it to you, you know, and have you up there standing and cheering, and somebody said back here a moment ago, give him hell, Hubert. It's too good for him. But I find now that my duty is to pronounce the benediction. And for those of you that do attend to your religious responsibilities, invocations are always longer than benedictions, except in this church. Because I got some benedicting I want to do with you today. You've heard from a very great senator, in fact several, but you heard yesterday from one of the men of the United States Senate that I hold in the greatest of admiration and respect. He gave you a powerful message. His timing was perfect. And you have resolved in support of that call for resignation of the president or the institution of the process under the Constitution of the United States for impeachment. You have honored a late and beloved president in the person of his gracious and talented and dedicated wife. And I want to personally express, as the former Vice President of the United States under the administration of Lyndon B. Johnson, my thanks for the high honor that you paid to the late president through his wife, the Murray Green Award of the AFL-CIO. Now, I'm going to possibly be a bit out of character for you today, because believe it or not, I had prepared what I would have considered a reasonably good political speech to talk to you about some of the hard realities of the politics that face us. But I'm not in the mood for it, because like you, a fellow American, I'm an unhappy man today, and it's difficult to make Hubert Humphrey unhappy, it's been said, but I am. I'm a sad man. I'm a troubled man. The entire nation is exactly in that frame of mind. So I come to you today at a troubled moment in the history of our nation. These are indeed times that try men's souls, and they're times that will test the strength of our political system and the very fabric of our society. And I come to counsel with you as a friend, seeking nothing, asking for nothing, except the opportunity to be with you, to talk to you, to share some thoughts with you, to speak of the law of this land, of our Constitution, of our political heritage and traditions, to speak to you of our country now as it is, and hopefully the better that it can be in the days that lie ahead. And it is from this perspective that I wish to address this assembly right now. Every school child is taught that we have a constitutional democracy, that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and that there are separate and co-equal branches of government. Every school child is taught that each officer of government solemnly takes an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States, and that the President himself, above all others, is required by the Constitution to not only faithfully uphold and defend it, but to execute faithfully the law of the land. That's why we speak of our presidency in such terms of respect and admiration. All school children are taught that every branch of the government has its powers carefully defined and limited by the Constitution. We have been taught that our constitutional heritage of limited powers was born out of a tragic experience with despots, with kings, who believed that they were above the law. And all of this has been capsuled not out of academic theory, but out of the crucible and the refiner's fire of experience in our Constitution, which outlines the structure of our government, defines its powers and duties, and states the purpose of government. Just listen for a moment, if you will, to the words of the preamble of the Constitution. And remember, the Constitution was not written in the past tense, even though we speak of our forefathers. It is written as if it were this very day, the document of the immediate moment. It is written in the present tense. We, the people of these United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. It's all there, my fellow Americans, all there, the whole purpose of our system, of our nation. It is there to establish justice and no man above the law. It is there to ensure domestic tranquility, a sense of harmony, not merely law and order. It is there to provide for the common defense, not only against the enemies beyond our shores, but even those within. It is there to promote the general welfare of all of the people, not just some. And it is there to secure, to make sure that we have the blessings of liberty. Coming with those blessings, the responsibilities of citizenship for ourselves and those yet unborn. There is not one word in this Constitution to protect the government from the people, but there is item after item and line after line to protect the people from the abusive power of government. Now that's my lesson to you this morning in constitutional law, but we need to think of it well. Throughout the years, you and I and many others of the democratic progressive tradition have called for a strong presidency. That call has gone from these conventions. As Adlai Stevenson once said, it is the only office that can represent all of the people. We need a strong president and a strong presidency, one who can stand up for the weak, One who will fight for the oppressed and the handicapped. One who has a sense of compassion and care for the elderly and the needy. We need a strong president who can and will stand up against the power of corporate wealth, and who can, by his inspiration and leadership, unite the American people in the pursuit of common goals. We need a strong president in the compassionate, progressive traditions of leadership that we found in a Franklin Roosevelt, even though a cripple could stand tall and strong, of a Harry Truman, who was fearless and courageous and decent and honest, of a John Kennedy, and of a Lyndon Baines Johnson. And there have been others. But a strong president does not mean an arrogant president. A strong president doesn't mean one who bypasses, circumvents, or violates the Constitution instead of breathing life into it. It does not mean a president who ignores the will of the elected representatives of the American people and thereby shows his contempt for the people. And it does not mean a president who will tolerate those around him who corrupt the election process. Strong presidents are only truly strong when they have the respect and the confidence and the trust and the faith and support of the people. Now, that respect and support have been seriously undermined in these recent days and months by what is known as Watergate and the unbelievable, incredible events of this past weekend. Yet it is the faith and confidence of the people in the government that gives meaning to popular government. Without that faith and confidence, believe me, the government cannot govern. President Nixon's actions have brought us to the brink of constitutional and governmental crisis, and there is no way to paint it over. The fact is here. This is not merely an issue for constitutional lawyers that you can hear on the Today Show or on any other television or radio broadcast. Nor is it an issue merely for academics. It's an issue that affects every American, no matter his station in life. Our existence as a democracy and our constitutional traditions of balanced and limited power are in mortal danger as of this hour. Our present dilemma has been precipitated by the effort of the executive branch of government through the presidency to relegate to itself powers belonging to others. While the president makes much of the separation of powers in defense of his position of executive privilege, he has, in fact, by his actions, made a mockery of separation of power. He takes power unto himself, and that is not separation of powers. These past months, we have witnessed the spectacle of corruption, wrongdoing, criminal acts, and irresponsibility in high places of government unfold before us like a tidal wave or a nightmare. When the principle of limited power is ignored and the concept of government of laws, not men, is cast aside, then the government, by the consent of the governed, is endangered. That's what it's all about. These are the basic problems and issues. The president's recent actions have shown us what happens when power is exercised without restraint. And when a president places his personal political welfare above the constitutional mandate and the requirements of the nation. That's what we've seen. James Madison once warned America about the risk of unchecked power when he said, quote, "The accumulation of all powers in the same hands, legislative, executive, and judicial, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny." These words were written almost 200 years ago, take on special meaning as we consider the events of the past months and weekend. At midnight Friday, The president chose not to appeal the Court of Appeals decision ordering him to turn over the tapes and documents to Judge Sirica. At that very moment, my fellow Americans, the court order became law. It is law, and it is this law, that the President of the United States, who has taken an oath to faithfully execute the laws, has refused to obey. A violation of law. Instead, the President tried in vain to get the special prosecutor to agree to a plan differing from the court's order. The special prosecutor would not and could not accept the plan, as you know, citing its legal inadequacies and its conflict with the mandate given him by the Congress, the Attorney General, and the President himself. The special prosecutor insisted that he would appear before Judge Sirica in opposition to the Nixon plan. Then the President took the step that authoritarian executives have traditionally resorted to. Namely, he liquidated the office of the special prosecutor and he ordered Mr. Cox to be fired. He asked the Attorney General to carry out the law, his directive, and refusing to do so, the Attorney General of the United States resigned. The order was again issued to the Deputy Attorney General. He too refused the President's order, and he was fired. A new acting Attorney General then removed the special prosecutor. Remember, my fellow Americans, a president who assured the nation that the executive office would give total cooperation to an independent special prosecutor, and a president who told us in national television that the Watergate belongs in the courts. That same president decreed by presidential order and edict that the courts would not be permitted to decide between him and the prosecutor. He, the president, would do the deciding. Now, you draw your own conclusions as to what kind of government that is. So I ask, and I ask this very hour, who will be the people's representative before the judge today or tomorrow? When the White House lawyers, paid by the people, argue that the court should modify its order to accept the Nixon plan. Who will be there to speak for the people? No one. That man has been fired. The nation is left with a president facing the possibility of a contempt of court order, a Justice Department that is shattered, and an impartial investigation of his administration halted. And all of these measures reflect the actions not of a constitutional president, but of a man obsessed with power. This pattern of exercising unrestrained power is dangerous, it is dictatorial, and it is unacceptable for a free people. Now, we've seen all of this played out in what we call Watergate. We have seen it as he illegally impounded the funds appropriated by the Congress for public purposes. We have seen it as his spokesmen openly falsify and misrepresent actions taken by his administration. We have seen it in secretive and illegal acts performed in the name of national security. It is inconceivable that a president of all the people, honored by that great office, would choose to rule by edict rather than by consent, that he would make himself both judge and jury, and that he would callously replace moral leadership with a political maneuver designed but to assure his survival. And this is exactly what the president has done. Therefore, the Congress and the judiciary have the responsibility to curb these improper uses of power. The American people must be reassured that justice cannot be dismantled by an elected official who views himself above the law. What America needs now is a white paper of truth, not a whitewash of an administration. Throughout this Watergate crisis, the Congress, the courts, and the special prosecutor have sought to avoid, and rightly so, the constitutional confrontation that we face today. And as I said, now it is up to the Congress and the judiciary to act, but to act responsibly, judiciously, to resolve this crisis. First, it is essential, absolutely essential, that a new special prosecutor be named and that his work be continued. And this can be done immediately either by Judge Sirica or by a special act of the Congress. There is precedent for both, but above all, it must be done. The new special prosecutor should have full access to all of the evidence that has been accumulated in this case and all the powers and resources of a truly independent prosecutor. A government does not investigate itself. A special prosecutor is needed. Until these investigations are completed, without now assessing guilt or innocence, a cloud of suspicion will hang over the presidency and over the president, his entire administration. It is essential that this new inquiry be beyond the political reach of the president. Now, secondly, instead of my standing here and rendering you personal judgment on impeachment itself, I urge the appropriate committees of Congress to act promptly and judiciously in considering the best possible procedures for looking into these tragic facts and events, to hold full and complete hearings as to ascertaining whether or not there are sufficient grounds for the proceedings of impeachment to take place by the House of Representatives. The Constitution places that responsibility for impeachment proceedings upon the House of Representatives. The Senate sits as judge and jury. As a senator, I believe it is my solemn duty, not to prejudge this case. But as a public official, it is also my duty to see that the Congress and the public has all of the facts on which to make the judgment. Thirdly, I would strongly urge Senator John Stennis to reconsider accepting the presidential request to hear the tapes until that select committee of the Senate has itself decided to accept the president's proposal, and I mean the full committee, and until the federal district court has ruled on its acceptability. My position in no way reflects upon the integrity and the competence of Senator Stennis, a man that I know well and hold in high esteem, and he is held in high esteem by the entire Congress. But his participation implies that the president's proposal is indeed an acceptable compromise and that the Senate has acquiesced. And as yet, my fellow Americans, neither the full committee nor the Senate has agreed to anything, and we ought to have it clear. I would hope that the district court would promptly rule on the acceptability of the so-called compromise and whether or not the president is in contempt of a court order. This is the court process, the judicial process. I believe that what I have outlined for you today is a reasoned course of action. Despite the gravity of these recent events, we must not let passion and prejudice interfere with the constitutional remedy at hand. We cannot indulge in any shortcuts. We are not on any lynching party. We're not out to get somebody. We must be out only to get the truth, the facts, and then let them speak for themselves. Our Constitution includes those three precious words called due process, four precious words called due process of law, procedures and procedural safeguards which are basic to a fair and just and free society. Procedure often determines the substance. Therefore, I caution every American not to fall prey to the abuse of rhetoric, just as the president has fallen prey to the abuse of power. Despite our outrage and our anxiety, we must pursue a course consistent with the law, the courts, and the Constitution. The safeguards of our system are all there. If we do not ignore them or abuse them, this republic is not going to fall. The moral stamina of the American people is still there. We are not going to collapse simply because one man and some of his cohorts have seen fit to abuse power. Power is still in the people. The Constitution says so, and we know so. Democrats and Republicans, citizens all alike from all walks of life, have a stake, an equal stake, in the resolution of this sordid and tragic affair. Our problems at home and abroad demand decisive action so that the business of our government can be pursued. There is work to be done, great and necessary things to do. You and I know that our economy is in trouble, and we can't gloss over it simply because of news flashes, traumatic experiences of a weekend. Inflation eats into the income of every working family, denying those families the full benefit of their hard-earned dollars. You and I know that the economic policies of this administration have rewarded the few and the rich and the powerful with excessive profits. Those are issues that are here that tie into our very lives. Yes, there is an unfinished agenda which we must complete, including health care legislation, tax reform, budget reform, campaign finance reform, voter registration reform, education of our young, care for our elderly, employment for our jobless. These problems confront us no matter who is president, or who is vice president, or who is attorney general, or who is special prosecutor, or who reads the tapes. Those are problems that are with us, and we must find some answers to them, just as we find answers to the constitutional crisis that besets us today. This great assembly of the representatives of the trade unionists and the industrial workers of America to help us build a veto-proof Congress. A veto-proof Congress. We have built bomb shelters to protect us from an enemy, but we have a Congress today that cannot protect us from the enemy to the public will of this country. Today we have a government by minority. One-third plus one, as we are unable to override veto after veto. We have government by edict, by one man. And I call upon this assembly of representatives to go back into their respective communities to help us put an end to minority rule in this country, to put an end to one-man rule in this country, to put an end to the grab for power in this country. We can and we must, and we got to get on with the job. Only 54 weeks from today, 54 weeks from this very day, the American people will once again go to the ballot box to decide the course that our country is to follow. A new Congress is to be elected, along with governors, legislators, and local officials. And dear friends, we must not permit cynicism born out of this sorrow and tragedy, bitterness and frustration, and division, disunity, to weaken our resolve. Surely we have learned what it means to lose elections. What a price we pay. We paid a terrible price for defeat. When we lose an election, someone else makes up the federal budget. When we lose an election, someone else designs and makes the economic policy. And those who already have too much get more. And those who are struggling to have enough get left out. That's what it means to lose elections. When we lose elections, someone else appoints the judges, and the courts make the law. Yes, losing elections is a painful and costly experience. I'll tell you what defeat has meant to us. Hardship for the American working family, elderly people that have been forced literally into a demeaning existence, distorted budget priorities, inequitable economic policies, phases, you know, vetoes, no-goes, slowdowns, impoundments, and corrupt leadership and election scandal. That's the price of division. That's the price of losing elections. You and I know, don't we? And dear friends, we cannot afford that luxury once again. We must reach out now to build a great coalition of decency in this country, a great coalition of progressive thought in this country. Not that of the extreme of either left or right, not that of new politics or old politics, but just good, decent politics for the American people. That's what is needed today. The American people have a right to know and a right to expect more than criticism and complaints from their political leaders and parties. They have a right to know what we're for. They have a right to know what direction we would have our nation go. Elections ought to be fought over the issue of national priorities, not only how much money we shall spend, but for what purposes shall we invest and spend. Therefore, I ask that we present strong policy leadership and policy goals to put America's house back in order. And if we don't, then we will have been as guilty in the tragedy of America as those who today, by their own actions, bring shame upon us. Here are some of the things that we must do and that we must have. A national food policy for the remainder, at least, of this decade to assure consumers of an adequate supply of food at reasonable prices and maximum production of food and fiber for export. We need a system of food reserves to protect the American consumer from wild price inflation and to provide the poor at home and abroad with a margin of safety for their survival. That's one thing that we've got to have. We cannot live and live well in a society of scarcity and short supply. Surely we know that we need a national energy policy to end our dependence on foreign suppliers to meet our energy needs. We must never again allow ourselves to be in a position where we can be threatened or blackmailed as we are today. And a national trade policy that encourages American exports but will not permit American workers to be the sacrificial lambs and the weaker and the victims of unfair competition. We need to export our goods, not our jobs. A national health policy to provide preventive and curative health care for all Americans. We fought for it for years. Yes, a program of national health insurance to cover the medical expenses of the American family and the expansion of health facilities and medical personnel. A national urban policy, because most of us live in cities, designed to make our cities livable, safe, and modern. We must not ignore the needs of our cities, because this neglect has become a new form of racism, because many of our minorities and our poor and our elderly today live in our cities. And this administration in Washington today has said goodbye. Goodbye and good night to urban America. We need a national transportation policy which includes a greater effort to improve not only farm-to-market roads and the great interstate highway system, but to expand and develop modern urban transit. Because again, it's a part of the national strategy and the national need. A national policy of equal rights and opportunities for all Americans. and not just a policy, but a firm commitment in industry, in every walk of life, as well as in government, that equal opportunity and civil and human rights is a fact of American life, like citizenship itself. We need that. And we need a national education policy that guarantees every boy and girl the opportunity for quality education from preschool through graduate school. These are things that the American labor movement has stood for. And we must work and work as never before for a united party and a united America. We cannot afford to pay the price of more election defeats. Already, my friends, defeat has cost us billions in income, billions in taxes. Already, defeat has cost us shame and tragedy. And I rise today and lift my voice to ask as a Democrat, speaking below now as a Democrat, for party, to end party disunity, but not at the price of basic principle, and to return to this country majority government, and to get away from minority government, government of one for the few, no, but government of the majority for the many. That is the purpose of this convention. That is my purpose in public life. Therefore, I ask you to join with me and with thousands of others to have a veto-safe Congress in 1974 and a president that we can be proud of that will represent the people in 1976.